Airplane Museum, or at Build-A-Bear. I've used them all. Each is engaging and creative and fun in its own way. Location drives content. It's why we should be as picky about where we talk as we are about what we actually discuss. If you have the right conversation at the right place, you just had the right conversation. However, if you have the right conversation at the wrong place, you just had the wrong conversation. I don't think people grow old. I think they just lose their imaginations and end up looking old. Tom Sawyer Island reminds me of who I am and who I'm becoming. It's a place Walt Disney created where people wouldn't stand forever in lines and can run and jump and remember who they really are. Most people spend more time looking for the car keys than they do their imaginations. I want to keep my imagination close where I can find it. I find it every Wednesday at my office. After several trips to Uganda, I asked the Chief Justice if he would ever consider coming to America. He said if he came to the United States someday, he'd like to see my office because I'd seen his. A few years later, when the Chief Justice arrived at Los Angeles International Airport, I asked him if he still wanted to see my office. He said he wanted it to be our first stop. We drove past all the high-rises towering above Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles and kept heading south. I'm sure he wondered more than once where we were going. A short time later, we pulled into the parking lot at Disneyland. He stepped out of the car and asked me, "You have an office here?" "Of course I do," I shot back. "You should see my pirate ship." I had Mickey Mouse ears made for him in advance. Embroidered on the front were the words, "The Chief," in yellow stitching. As I slipped on his ears, I told the Chief Justice it was kind of a rule that anybody coming to Disneyland for the first time had to wear the Mickey Mouse ears all day long. So he did. I took him on the Jungle Cruise, so we'd know what Africa really looked like. Then we made our way to the Indiana Jones ride. When the ride ended, I turned to him, my arms still up in the air, and asked, "Wasn't that just like the movie?" The Chief Justice looked puzzled and asked, "There's a movie?" I knew we'd never run out of things to talk about. Later, he came over to our house and pulled his key out of his pocket. He slipped it into the lock and turned it tentatively. Of course, it worked, and he turned to me with a mile-wide grin. Before we left Disneyland, the Chief Justice and I took the raft over to Tom Sawyer Island. We sat at my office and talked about kids and justice and hope again. Our conversation took a sober turn when we talked about witch doctors and child sacrifice. To modern ears, this sounds like something that might have happened 100 years ago or more, but it's happening now. Almost 1,000 children were abducted by witch doctors in a single year in Uganda alone. The belief among witch doctors is that the head or blood or private parts of their victims have magical powers. They bury them in foundations of buildings and use them for ceremonies and other horrible practices. Mothers will protect their newborn baby girls by piercing their ears at birth, hoping they'll no longer represent a perfect sacrifice. Thousands of people in Uganda have been affected by witch doctors, yet in the history of the country, no one had ever taken on a witch doctor in the legal system. In part, this is because the young victims never survive. The other reality is that many, including some judges, are afraid of the witch doctors. I asked the Chief Justice if he would let me be part of a trial against a witch doctor if we ever found a victim who lived. He said he would. It was the right conversation at the right place. I've been traveling to Uganda regularly now for almost 2 decades with a nonprofit I started called Love Does, which has the goal of helping children throughout the world. We've tried cases involving minors wrongfully stuck in prisons, and we operate schools and safe houses in Uganda, Iraq, Somalia, Nepal, and India for kids who need an education and for young girls who have been rescued from horrible circumstances. On a trip to a prison in the bush in Uganda, far from any major city, I met a young girl. She was 13 years old and had been in prison for 2 years. I asked the warden what the charge was, and he said she was being held for kidnapping. She had been accused of the crime, taken to prison the same day, and remained locked up for 2 years without ever stepping into a courtroom. It's impossible to completely read somebody in a short visit, but I just wasn't getting the "I'm a kidnapper" vibe from this girl. So I asked her what had happened. She told me she had been asked to take a baby to a child's mother in a neighboring village. You and I would have asked more questions, of course, but she was a young peasant girl who was used to doing what she was told. She took the baby to a hut and put the child in the arms of someone she thought was the baby's mother. As soon as she stepped outside the hut, she heard the baby crying. It wasn't the normal cry of an infant. It was a desperate scream. It turns out this wasn't the baby's mother at all. She had been tricked into taking the baby to a witch doctor for a child sacrifice. Before the baby's life was taken, the peasant girl rushed back in, grabbed the child, and ran back home. By then, the villagers had realized the baby was missing, and when she returned with the child, she was arrested. The warden was present during this conversation, so I asked him which jail held the witch doctor who was going to sacrifice the child. I wanted to get the other side of the story. The warden shook his head. No arrest had been made. No questions had been asked. No one went after the witch doctor. What? I almost yelled. It was the moment I decided I was going to do something. Someone once asked me what I would write if I only had 6 words for my autobiography. Here's what I came up with. What if we weren't afraid anymore? Throughout history, God has spoken 3 words more often than any others when the people he loved were scared and confused, lost or lonely, paralyzed or stuck. In those times, he usually didn't make a big speech. He just said to his people, "Be not afraid." The police don't arrest witch doctors because they're afraid of them, and the judges don't try cases against witch doctors for the same reason. As I drove away from the prison after meeting that 13-year-old girl, 2 things happened. First, I got a hold of a judge, and we set a date to bring her case to trial, which later resulted in her release and return to her family. The second thing was equally subtle and powerful. It wasn't an audible voice, but it was as if 3 words were tattooed on my heart that day. I bet you know what they were. I knew we were going to find a witch doctor and bring them to justice. I wanted every witch doctor to know we weren't afraid of them anymore. Chapter 22. Witch Doctors and Witness Stands. Courage comes in all sizes. Kabi was head of all the witch doctors in his region of northern Uganda. He was my age and had no hair on his head, no stubble on his face, and no smile. It was like all the hate in his life had congregated on his face. It was worn and stern, and his bloodshot eyes had a yellowish hue. Kabi was the most evil person I've ever met. An 8-year-old boy, we'll call Charlie, was walking home from school when Kabi abducted him. Kabi took Charlie into the bush, cut off his private parts, and left him for dead. But Charlie didn't die. Kabi was arrested a short time later, and for the first time in Uganda's history, we had one of the leaders of the witch doctors and a victim who was alive. Once I learned about Charlie, I immediately got on a plane to go see my friend, the chief. Because we'd had the right conversation at the right place on Tom Sawyer Island, I felt a huge sense of anticipation that something big was unfolding. The plane couldn't fly fast enough. When I landed in Uganda, I drove several hours into the bush to meet Charlie for the first time. Charlie was dressed in loose clothing and looked down, afraid to make eye contact. He'd been through much, and it showed. Earlier that day, Charlie had identified his attacker in a lineup from a distance at the prison. I asked him a few questions, but it was clear he was in no condition to talk. Our conversations would come much later. After this first encounter with Charlie, I went to meet with a high court justice to ask if he would be willing to have the case against Kabi brought to trial in his court. His office felt heavy as we spoke, as if it were weighed down by the tremendous gravity of the moment. We both knew what we were discussing. This would be Uganda's first case in which the death penalty was being sought against a witch doctor. It was uncharted territory. It might work, and it might be a total failure. What then? The witch doctors had gripped the whole country with fear. When we set out to bring the case against Kabi to trial, I have to admit, I was more than a little skeptical about whether we'd be able to find a judge brave enough to take on this case. All the odds said we'd strike out, But within a week, this courageous judge agreed. We had a courtroom and a trial date for Uganda's first case against a witch doctor. It turned out we weren't the only ones who wanted to fight. When the local witch doctors found out the judge had taken the case, they began appearing at his home and did some pretty creepy things. He could have backed out. Many would have. Instead, he surrounded his homes with guards who had plenty of firepower. Great love often involves tremendous risk. This amazing judge was willing to push back against the darkness. He was turning into love. The date of the trial was set several months out. Prior to the trial, I made several trips back and forth to Uganda to meet with the witnesses, the police, the investigators, and Charlie. The day finally came for the trial to begin. Kabi arrived in chains, surrounded by a dozen well-armed soldiers. A few of us were staying across the street from the courthouse in a thatched hut. Our country director, who we called Two-Bunk John, had arranged everything. We brought in a projector, a generator, and a screen to give visual evidence of what happened. We had binders full of notes and legal documents to explain what the laws of the country were. One High Court justice and several tribal leaders were present. Uganda still uses the British system in the judiciary, so everyone wears white powdered wigs, black capes, and ruffled white shirts. It's impressive, even more so in this setting in the bush in Uganda. The soldiers surrounded the courthouse as the judge gaveled the room to order. We had received permission from the judge to videotape the trial because it was a first in the country, so I purchased a video camera that cost me more than my first two cars in college. Two-Bunk John was operating the camera. At one point, I was asking questions in the trial and saw Kabi look up at John and stare at the camera. John's face turned to ash, and he pulled his eye away from the eyepiece suddenly. At one of the breaks, Two-Bunk showed me the video clip. As Kabi raised his head and started staring at the camera, the video fizzled out to black and white static, like a television that stopped working. I assumed the witch doctor's death stare was covered by Nikon's warranty, so we shared a nervous laugh, got out another camera, and got back to work. People like John, who were turning into love, get distracted, but they don't stay that way for long. The next session in the trial would be Charlie's testimony. When the judge reconvened the trial, Charlie entered the room. He was told to tell the truth and was asked what happened. This 8-year-old kid stood up the size of a mountain, pointed at Kabi and said, "That's the man who tried to kill me." Charlie reminded me of another boy with 5 smooth stones facing a giant. That boy didn't back down, and Charlie didn't either. The courtroom was silent as everyone witnessed his courage. Without flinching, Charlie gave the details of what had happened to him. Sometimes I've wondered what difference one person can make in the world. I have a red plate at home that says I'm very special. We get it out on birthdays. The plate doesn't make me special, though. It's the people surrounding me and my plate who make me special. The same is true for you. Still, I feel pretty small most of the time. When I saw Charlie's courage, he didn't need a plate, and he wasn't small. He cast a shadow of courage bigger than any NFL linebacker. What is it that you don't think you can do? What do you think is too big for you, or too scary, or too risky? Sometimes God whispers it, and sometimes he shouts it. Whatever the volume, I bet he's always using the same 3 words with us. Be not afraid. When Charlie finished giving his testimony and answered all the questions and cross-examinations, he got off the stand. He looked exhausted but unshaken. This was the first time since the attack he had been this close to Kabi. I took him outside and told him how proud of him I was. I touched him on the nose and said to him, "Charlie, you were brave. You were courageous, and you weren't afraid." A small smile spread across his face. The trial took the rest of the week to finish. A short time later, we received the judge's guilty verdict. In Uganda, once the judge signs the verdict, the custom is to take the pen, break it, and throw it off the table. Then the judge says with an unmatched finality, "What's been done today will never be undone." When the judge signed Kabi's order and said the words, it meant Kabi would never be seen again. The word of Kabi's conviction went out to 44 million people. The courage of a 4-foot-tall boy had changed the history of an entire nation. We had done it, the very first witch doctor conviction in Ugandan history. I'll be honest, while sad about Charlie's loss, I was pleased with the outcome of the trial. Justice had been served, and it paved the way for a more courageous stance for these types of crimes against children. But then something happened I didn't expect. I started wondering about Kabi. Every fiber of my being wanted him to rot in the jail that would be his home for the rest of his life. I was okay with that, but my heart felt dark when I thought about Kabi. It felt far from God, and I didn't like it. Jesus was talking to his friends one day, and he explained how he wanted us to live our lives. He pulled his friends in close and said something I bet surprised them. He didn't say they needed to use bigger words in their prayers, or go to church more, or not chew tobacco or dance. It wasn't behaviors he talked about. He said if we wanted to please God, we needed to love our enemies. I've already told you how I found it's a lot easier to agree with Jesus than to do what he says. The command to love our enemies is a good example. The truth is, I don't want to love mine. My enemies are creepy. They're mean and uncaring. They're selfish and full of pride. Some try to hurt little kids. Jesus didn't come to make us look like we've got it together. He came to let us know how to be like him. I'm all for that. But does loving my enemies include guys like Kabi? I don't think so. But here's where I'm stopped dead in my tracks. On the day Jesus died on the cross, he was broken for us, not unlike the judge's pen. It was like God saying, what's been done today will never be undone. Paul was one of the people who talked about Jesus. He explained grace in this way. He said, neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither present nor future, nor any powers, neither height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation could ever separate us from the love of God. What he was saying is the horrible things we've done won't separate us from God, and they won't separate you, they won't separate me, and they won't separate Kabi either. Honestly, it's hard for me to believe this. It may be hard for you too. Jesus explained the reason he wanted us to love our enemies was so we could be perfect, the way his Father in heaven is perfect. Perfect? Ha! Most of us have spent most of our lives just trying to be nice some of the time, not cutting in line and only calling people names under our breath. Sure, we could give someone a small break by saying something generous after they've been awful to us. Maybe we could even forgive someone, at least on the surface, for a deep hurt they caused. Doing things like this have been the high water mark we only hit once in a while, if at all. Our problem following Jesus is we're trying to be a better version of us rather than a more accurate reflection of him. I've met very few people who didn't like Jesus. I mean, who wouldn't? It's easy to admire Jesus and think he's a nice guy, but there's a big difference between liking Jesus and being like him. And he said we would never be able to be like him unless we loved our enemies. I've never wondered if someone could be perfect. I don't mean someone like Jesus, of course, but someone like you and me. I've never even heard of anyone jumping out of bed in the morning and saying their goal for the day was to be perfect. When I met Sweet Maria, I remember thinking she was perfect, but I knew she really wasn't. I had a job once I thought was perfect for me, and it was a great job, but honestly, it wasn't perfect. We don't think perfect is possible, so we just nod and agree, rather than doing the heavy lifting Jesus talked about to get there. The idea that we could be perfect, like our Father in heaven, sounds like a beautiful idea, but not something we could ever really achieve. I wonder if God thought loving our enemies would be just as hard. Perhaps instead of an impossible task in our lives, it's the report card on our faith. Maybe God made loving him and our enemies the easiest way to tell whether we just agree with Jesus or if we want to be perfect like him. No doubt, Kabi was my enemy, but he was also my chance to become more like Jesus. And now I had a courageous teacher who was only 4 feet tall to guide me. Chapter 23, Randy's Skill. God restores what he creates. On the other side of the world, a man walked into the emergency room of a hospital in Los Angeles. He had been involved in a horrible accident in his wood shop. His right hand had been completely severed, and he was carrying it in his left hand. Calls were immediately made to get one of the few surgeons who would be able to deal with such a massive and complex injury. It would be hero's work, even for the world's best surgeons. Randy arrived, scrubbed in, and began what would be an 18-hour surgery. With scores of labeled hemostats, he identified and numbered each of the hundreds of tendons, veins, arteries, and muscles on both sides of the injury. One by one, he reconnected them, never flinching, never losing concentration. He did the painstaking, nearly impossible work of reconnecting this man's hand to his body again. I saw a video of Randy a few months later shaking hands with this carpenter who had regained full use of his hand. Only a handful of the best surgeons in the world could have done this operation. Randy was one of them. Randy loves airplanes. There aren't many he hasn't flown. He was learning how to fly a de Havilland Beaver seaplane near Seattle. The person teaching him took him in the off-season over the border to Canada, far up an inlet. Unbeknownst to me, they landed at my lodge and walked around a little. While they were exploring, the instructor, who is a friend of mine, told Randy about a little boy in Uganda who had suffered a massive injury with a machete. He learned about a witch doctor who had committed a crime, a guilty verdict, and a little boy who was horribly disfigured. The extent of Charlie's injuries is tough for most to imagine. Justice had been done to Cobby, but Charlie wasn't whole, not by a far reach. There would be many challenges ahead for him. Charlie would never be able to be a father when he grew up because of the body parts he lost. At some point, Charlie's friends would no doubt find out about his disfigurement and tease him as well. He would have extensive mental and emotional healing to do in addition to the physical. At home in San Diego, the phone rang and I answered. The voice on the other side said, "Bob, you don't know me, but my name is Randy. I heard what happened to the kid in Uganda. I want you to know something." There was a pause as I leaned into the phone. I could feel Randy's seriousness. "I can fix him," he said. His words hung in the airwaves. I was polite with the stranger over the telephone, but was thinking, "Buddy, you don't understand about all the things that were cut off. You can't fix that." Sensing this, Randy continued, "I'm a surgeon at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. Really, I can fix him." I drove to Los Angeles and we met at a restaurant with my friend Don. Randy started drawing on a napkin what he was going to do to replace the numerous body parts Charlie had lost. Even on a napkin, it was way too much information. If they find that napkin the next time I go through security at the airport, I'll go to jail. Randy explained how we would take parts from Charlie's leg and from his arm and make new parts, but there was a caveat. Randy explained how even the best surgeons can only do so much. After the surgery, while Charlie wouldn't run the risk of being teased because some of what he lost could be replaced, he would still lack what was necessary to be able to be a biological father in the future. The kind of restoration needed for those missing body parts was simply beyond anyone's medical capability. I hesitated after seeing how involved the surgery would be, but finally had to ask, "Randy, what would this operation cost?" I was guessing millions. Without skipping a beat, Randy looked up and said, "I'll do it for nothing." "I can afford nothing," I thought. But there had to be a catch, right? While Randy might waive his fee, what about the nurses and the equipment and all that stuff? It turns out there's a fantastic organization that helps cover the costs of these kinds of operations. Knowing I wouldn't be hit unexpectedly with a crazy bill, I got another plane ticket and headed back to Uganda to find Charlie in the bush in northern Uganda. Once I had him, I packed a few things and we got in the car. Our first stop was the courthouse in the capital. A short time later, we stood before a Ugandan high court judge, and I became Charlie's legal guardian. Charlie's father had long since abandoned him and was nowhere to be found. His mother, a peasant woman, had distanced herself from Charlie as well. I'm not judging them in this. It's just a fact and not uncommon, unfortunately. When we got to the airport, Charlie stared out the terminal window without saying a thing. He'd never even seen an airplane before. I tried to explain the whole thing about going into the air and how safe it was, but he wasn't buying it. After a little coaxing and a couple candy bars, we got on the plane and flew to London. When we arrived, we were holding hands as we got off the plane. Charlie asked, "Father, can we just walk the rest of the way?" I can imagine how he must have felt. I broke the bad news to him about the Atlantic Ocean and the polar cap we were about to fly over. I tried not to freak him out, but I think I did again. Once inside the terminal, I opened my laptop to see if there were any urgent messages. In my inbox, there was an email that stood out. The title was simple. It just said White House in the subject line. I have many friends who like to play pranks on me, so I immediately went down the list of suspects in my mind. It was a long list. The body of the message was brief. It read, "We'd like to meet Charlie." After a couple of quick calls, I confirmed that, incredibly, the invitation was legit. We got back on the plane and flew to Washington, D.C. This kid was standing in the bush in northern Uganda 2 days before and was now standing in President Obama's Oval Office. Charlie walked over to the wall and pointed to a document hanging in a frame. "What's this?" he asked. We spent the next 10 minutes talking about the Emancipation Proclamation, signed by Abraham Lincoln. Before we left, Charlie grabbed an apple from the bowl on the coffee table between two sofas and took a bite. You know, the one next to the eagle emblem in the carpet. I leaned over to Charlie and whispered, "Don't drip." Why does God do things like this? The honest answer is, I'm not really sure, but I've got a good guess. I think he wants to blow our minds. There's a letter in the Bible Paul sent to some of his friends. He was trying to explain something similar. He acknowledged not many of the people he was writing to were wise or powerful or born into famous families, but he said God uses unbelievable things, just like what happened to Charlie, so we wouldn't keep making everything about ourselves, but instead we would see how powerful God is. The next day we left Washington, D.C. We flew to Los Angeles for Charlie's operation. Any kid who is headed to that kind of operation needs to go to the happiest place on earth, so I took him to Disneyland. I know several of the characters there, and they made him feel special. Tinkerbell is a friend of mine and is about Charlie's size. We arranged for them to spend some time together. He kept looking at her wings and touching them in amazement. She wrapped her arms around him and told him what a brave young man he was. I think I saw the two of them lift off the ground a little as she did. The next morning, I put Charlie in his hospital gown and got him on the gurney to be taken to the operating room. Before they rolled him into surgery, I prayed for him and Randy. Then I gave Charlie a kiss on the forehead, and I said the words God's been saying over each of us since the beginning of time and the beginning of our lives. I whispered in his ears, "Charlie, be not afraid." By the end of the 8-hour surgery, Randy had done what he does better than anyone else in the world. Charlie was restored. Chapter 24. Cobby. What we punish, God can forgive. The minute he attacked Charlie, Cobby became my enemy. He wasn't a little evil, he was pure evil. It's easy to talk a good game about loving your enemies until you have one. I realized if I wanted big things to happen in my life, I'd need to take bigger steps and risk more than I had before, so I decided to visit Cobby in prison. Cobby had been sent to Lazira Maximum Security Prison. Lazira is one of the scariest places on the planet. It was built in 1920 for 200 death row inmates. There are over 3,000 men in Lazira today. There are no windows in most places. If you go to Lazira, you go to die. I contacted the warden at the Lazira prison. I gave him my name and said I'd like to see Cobby. He told me absolutely not. It was a maximum security prison, and no one gets in to see people like Cobby. I told the warden I was the honorary consul for the Republic of Uganda, and after a short pause, he said, "You're in." Cobby entered the dark room where I was waiting. He had no shoes and was wearing a torn and dirty prison uniform. When he entered, he took a knee and told me how bad he felt about what he had done to Charlie. Skeptical, I thought he was just sorry because we had caught and punished him. He told me what it was like growing up the son of a witch doctor and what witchcraft had done to him over the course of his life. Then he said something that stunned me. He said, "I know I'm going to die in here. What I really need is forgiveness." His words hung in the air like a fog. Forgiveness? For a witch doctor who tried to sacrifice Charlie? My immediate reaction was absolutely not. He tried to kill the little boy I love. But something inside me had started to change. The change hadn't been nearly fast enough, but it was nevertheless happening. I didn't see a killer in front of me. I felt like I was looking at a criminal hanging on a cross next to Jesus. I thought of the words Jesus spoke to that criminal. "Today, you will be with me in paradise." There wasn't a quiz Jesus gave to the criminal to get in. He didn't ask the guy about his positions on a host of social issues. He didn't ask him to change his behaviors or say a prayer first. He just said, "You're in." Standing in a dark room next to death row is a long way from paradise. Cobby and I talked a while about his family and what was important to him. I talked about my family and what was important to me. We talked about what I was learning but still didn't have figured out yet about love and grace and forgiveness and Jesus. Then something happened that will forever shape my understanding about the things Jesus talked about. Cobby said he wanted to put his faith and life in the strong and kind arms of Jesus. When he did this, you could say he was coming to Christ, as people in many faith communities would. But in a way, I was too, because I was moving away from just agreeing with Jesus to doing what he said when he talked about loving my enemy. What Cobby and I are both learning about love and grace and forgiveness is that none of us needs to fully understand it to fully receive it. I've met with Cobby quite a few times since he began his adventure with Jesus inside the walls of Lazira. When I do see him, I don't see a felon anymore. I see a guy trying to follow Jesus just like I am. While our life experiences and circumstances could not be more different, it turns out many of the problems we have turning into the men we want to be are the same. After one of my meetings with Cobby outside of his cell, I asked the warden if anyone had come to talk to the inmates about what Jesus said our lives could look like with him at the center. At first he waved me off, but then, as if I'd done a Jedi move, he said he'd let Cobby talk to them. A couple of trips later, Cobby and I stood, holding hands, in the courtyard of Lazira Maximum Security Prison, with my son Richard and a few other friends. I listened while Cobby told 3,000 dying men about the new life he had started with Jesus. I know what many of them were thinking. "Wait, this is Cobby, the witch doctor. The evil guy. Jesus? Him? Unbelievable." Cobby spoke for 30 minutes. Honestly, I've never heard anyone hack the gospel message worse than Cobby did that day. His message was garbled and halting, and he barely got anything right. By the time he was done, I wondered if I even believed in Jesus anymore. But here's the thing. Every guy in that place knew who Cobby was and what he had done, and more than a few knew I was the guy who put him there. Standing in the courtyard together, not as enemies, but as brothers, filled in all the words Cobby had messed up about Jesus. This is the story Jesus came to tell in your life, my life, and Cobby's life. He said he would turn us into love if we were willing to leave behind who we used to be. When Cobby finished giving the best, worst sermon I'd ever heard, hundreds of guys started walking toward us. Cobby picked up a water bottle, as did a couple of our other friends, and he started baptizing the other prisoners. At first I was thinking, "Wait, you can't do that, Cobby. You hardly know anything about your faith. You know almost none of the doctrine, and you're a killer too." But while I rattled through all the reasons he couldn't, Cobby kept splashing water over the heads of these men, inviting them to begin the adventure of becoming love themselves. I realized in that moment, Cobby probably knows more about Jesus and forgiveness than most of us. Was this how it was supposed to happen? Yes and no, I suppose. Cobby had been responsible for unthinkable pain in other people's lives and had experienced tremendous loss in his own. He's not a guy who's comfortable like me. He's a guy who is desperate enough for Jesus that he's willing to make huge changes in his life. Does he have the knowledge? Nope. Jesus chose fishermen who rarely got their nets on the right side of the boat, By all accounts, even after they had been with Jesus for 3 years, they still didn't fully understand who he was. They were imperfect, flawed, and had failed, sometimes big. I was reminded again how grace never seems fair until you need some. It's hard to ignore that most of the people doing the talking from up front are guys like me who seem pretty nice and relatable. They make us feel comfortable, yet the people Jesus used more often were the ones who had messed up big and were desperate like Cobby. When Cobby was done baptizing the death row inmates, he turned and walked deliberately towards me. When he reached me, he grabbed my hands. He looked me in the eyes and he said in a strong and kind voice, "Bob, I forgive you." "Wait, what?" This took me by surprise. "Hold on, you're the bad guy. You can't forgive me," I was thinking. "You're the guy who is a convict. You're the guy who was wrong, who failed, who hurt people, who caused tremendous pain. You don't know anything close to what I know about Jesus. I just heard you say a bunch of stuff about Jesus that wasn't even right." But then I realized what was happening. We had just been reading together what Jesus said to his friends about loving our enemies. Cobby knew if I was his enemy, he couldn't be perfect like his Father in heaven was. And that's what he wanted, bad enough to do something about it. In that moment, standing in the prison courtyard, I didn't see a witch doctor I helped convict. I saw Jesus standing barefoot in Cobby's clothes. I saw a guy who was becoming love. Chapter 25. Where do you want to go? Big love takes us to high places. Every one of my kids went on a 10-year-old birthday adventure with Dad. For each of them, it always started with the question, "Where do you want to go?" This question wasn't intended to ask, "What do you want to see?" It was more important than that, more charged with possibility. "Where do you want to go?" really meant, "Who are you becoming, and where can we go to help you get closer to that?" Lindsay, our oldest, chose London for high tea because she's half Mary Poppins and all courage. Richard chose climbing Half Dome because he never backs down from a good challenge. Adam chose to ride across the desert on dirt bikes because even then he was a guy who loved adventure. Guess who turned 10? Charlie. I felt like I was 10 years old all over again when I got on my knees and asked him in my most enthusiastic voice, "Charlie, where do you want to go?" He didn't miss a beat and shouted, "Mount Kilimanjaro!" I wasn't expecting that one at all. I asked him if he would rather go back to Disneyland or to SeaWorld or maybe go to one of those indoor climbing gyms. Not a chance. His mind was made up. He wanted to climb the highest mountain in Africa. I think it's because he wanted to prove to himself he could ascend just about anything. A few months later, I got mountaineering clothes, 2 plane tickets, and we headed for Tanzania. When we got to the foot of Mount Kilimanjaro, someone pointed up towards the cloud-covered mountaintop and asked, "Doesn't that look awesome?" I looked at him and just shook my head. I wanted to hurl. The mountain is 19,341 feet tall, and we were at the bottom of it. Actually, I was standing in a ditch at the time, so it made it 3 feet taller. I asked around to find out how the mountain got its name. I figured there was some reason it had the word kill in it. Because it's the tallest mountain in Africa and covered in snow at the top, it turns out people sometimes die trying to climb it. Charlie, a couple friends, and I started hiking up the mountain behind our guide. People have asked me what the views were like going up Kilimanjaro. I've told them I don't know. The whole way up, I just kept my eyes fixed on the guide's boots and never looked up. A few times, he went over a rock when I would have rather gone around it. But if he went over it, I went over it. Other times, he went around a rock I would have rather gone over. But if he went around it, I went around it too. Here's what I learned. When you've got a guide you can trust, you don't have to worry about the path you're on. It's the same lesson I've been learning about Jesus. I'm just trying to follow love's lead. We walked for 40 miles to the top of the mountain and down again, and the guide never tripped once. By contrast, it seemed I tripped every 3 or 4 steps. But do you know what happened every time I tripped? I just bumped into the guide again. Even though it happened often, the guide never turned around and gave me the hairy eyeball or told me to get my balance. He just knew I was following him closely. I think Jesus feels the same way about us. We're all going to trip as we try to follow him through the difficult terrain of our lives. But when we do, we'll just bump into him all over again. Following Jesus means climbing, tripping, dusting ourselves off, and climbing some more. Faith isn't a business trip walked on a sidewalk. It's an adventure worked out on a steep and sometimes difficult trail. I was in a big hurry when we started climbing Kilimanjaro. It was a mixture of fear and excitement and the buzz from downing a half dozen Hershey bars. I was also looking for a bathroom. The guide shook his head at me as I hopped off rocks and jumped over logs. Every few minutes he would say to me, "Bob, pole, pole." I asked him what this meant. In Swahili, pole pole means slowly, slowly. I can't lie. For a guy who does everything fast, that's hard advice to receive, and even harder advice to follow. By the end of the first day, though, as I laid in my tent sore, beat up, and with every muscle on fire, I knew why he'd been saying pole, pole. It's hard to walk with Jesus and run ahead of him at the same time. Yet I've been doing that my whole life. I've misunderstood going slow as lacking enthusiasm and going fast as joy. I've confused patience as a lack of will and activity as purpose. What I learned from our guide is that I could either run fast or get to the top of the mountain. I couldn't do both. We need to decide the same in our faith. It's easy to confuse busyness with progress and accomplishments with pleasing Jesus. Every day we get to decide whether we're really following Jesus or treating him like he's a Sherpa carrying our stuff. It took 5 days, but I made it to the top of Kilimanjaro. My first thought at the summit was, "Where's the air?" as I grabbed my throat. Brave little Charlie made it to 16,400 feet. This was to be his personal summit. To give context, this is higher than the summit of Mount Rainier in North America. That's not bad for a 4-foot-tall kid who just came through a big operation. Before Charlie headed back down the mountain with one of the guides, we had a ceremony. I had brought 15 medals with me and started pinning them on Charlie's jacket. I said, "Charlie, you're brave," and pinned on the first medal. I said, "Charlie, you're courageous," and pinned on a second one. Medal after medal hung on his chest as I spoke words of truth and encouragement and love over him. As I put the last medal on him, I said, "Charlie, you're a mountain climber," and gave him a hug. He looked like Colin Powell as he walked off that mountain. The most important part of our ceremony wasn't what I said or all the medals. It was what I didn't say. You see, I didn't tell Charlie how far he had to go. I said, "Charlie, look how far you've come." People who are becoming love celebrate how far people around them have come. They're constantly asking the question, "Where do you want to go?" Then they help the people around them get there. Go do that with the people you love, including your enemies. Don't talk to them about their failures and the dark places they've been. Talk to them about who they're becoming and the bright hope that is their future. Speak truthful and wise words over them. Bring a few medals, too. As you put the last one on their chest, look them in the eye and tell them, "Look how far you've come." Knowing that the journey you and I are on never really ends, we can ask the people we love one of the most important questions ever conceived. Where do you want to go? Chapter 26, Graduation Day. Love always multiplies itself. Ever since the trial against Cobby, I've been meeting with witch doctors. My daughter-in-law, Ashley, who is also an attorney, got in a car with a friend and traveled around the country educating Ugandan high court judges on what the law is and how to bring these cases to trial. When I go to Uganda now, I send out word on the bush radio in the north that the honorary consul of Uganda has arrived and all the witch doctors are required to meet with me in the king's hut. They aren't, of course, but I'm a lawyer. I make them believe they are. The craziest part is this. They come. Hundreds and hundreds of them. I've met with almost 1,000 witch doctors so far. Some of them are pretty creepy. Several have brought little dolls that look like me, and they stick pins in them while I talk. It's a little like being a pastor at some churches, I suppose. But we're not afraid of these guys. They've got nothing compared to the kind of power love has. Before I meet with witch doctors in the King's Hut, I'll go out into the bush and set up a sting. I have a camera that looks like a watch, and another that looks like a pin. I go to a village posing as a wealthy businessman from Kampala, and I ask the local witch doctor if he would help me find a kid for a child sacrifice if I needed one. Sadly, without exception, they offer to find one for $30. Later, when I meet with all the witch doctors in the King's Hut, I show them the video from the sting, and I tell them, "You see this guy? He's as good as dead. You even talk about sacrificing a kid, it's over for you too." I try to absolutely terrify them. By the looks of their big eyes and body language, it usually works. Because I'm learning about loving my enemies, I don't stop there. People who are becoming loved don't just use tough talk, they do difficult things. So after I scare the wits out of these witch doctors, I get on my knees and I wash their feet. When I do, I don't know who's more freaked out, them or me. I'm guessing me, because I'm not a toe guy. Here's the thing. Loving people the way Jesus did either changes everything in us or it changes nothing. It can't just change a couple things, but it can change a couple things at a time. If you want to become love, what will it change for you? We're all learning about loving our enemies. Draw a circle around yourself and go love the people in that circle. Fill it with people, the ones you've been avoiding, the ones you disagree with, the ones who are hard to get along with. Go find a couple witch doctors. I bring my friends with me now when I meet with the witch doctors. Honestly, it's blowing our minds. Greg has been a friend of mine for years, and we've traveled together to Uganda dozens of times. After he washed the feet of one of the witch doctors, the witch doctor kneeled and asked Greg if he could wash his feet. I watched this go down from across the room. It was a beautiful, tear-filled moment for us all. The witch doctor was just as blown away at what was happening as Greg was. I think this is exactly the kind of stuff Jesus talked about when he said we needed to love our enemies. Jesus said being right with him meant loving people who got things wrong. On one trip, before we left, I asked the new leader of the witch doctors what they needed. I was surprised by the answer. He said, "People think we have power, so they want us around, but they don't really like us, so we're very isolated." I told him I was a lawyer and knew exactly how he felt. "But most of us don't even know how to read or write," he continued. Loving your enemies doesn't just mean learning about them or being nice to them or tolerating them. It means helping them. So I started a witch doctor school. I know. Don't freak out. Sometimes I wonder if this is crazy, but then I see what has been happening in the witch doctors' lives, and I don't think so anymore. We don't teach them how to be witch doctors. They already know how to do that. We teach the witch doctors at our school how to read and write. We've got hundreds of witch doctors currently enrolled in the school and have graduated hundreds more. Get this. The only books we have in the witch doctor's school to teach them how to read are the Bible and Love Does. If you've read either of these, you've been reading their textbooks. Bad guys who used to sacrifice children are now learning their ABCs. And you know what? Things are changing, and not just for the witch doctors. One of the biggest changes has been in my own heart. I'm learning to love these people who used to be my enemies. I'm moving beyond just agreeing with Jesus to actually doing what he said to do. Truth be known, my life is probably changing as much as theirs. I've seen changes in the lives of the witch doctors as they experience the kind of love and acceptance Jesus talked about. Our Ugandan friends who are afraid of witch doctors think we're nuts. We do too. Loving people the way Jesus did means being constantly misunderstood. People who are becoming loved don't care. They'll do whatever it takes to reach whoever is hurting. We recently graduated our third class from the witch doctor school. Most of these witch doctors have more joy than teeth. Incredibly, we got the government to recognize their accomplishments. They now receive certificates of literacy issued by the Republic of Uganda at their graduation. Who could have imagined this would be possible? There's a simple answer. Jesus did. Loving our enemies has always been his idea, not ours. The people who creep us out aren't obstacles to having faith, they're opportunities to understand it. Our graduation ceremonies are unlike anything you could imagine. There's no public display of affection in Uganda. Nevertheless, as I give the witch doctors their diplomas, I hold their faces between my hands and I kiss them on the forehead. I want to be every witch doctor's first kiss. I look into some pretty creepy sets of eyes and tell them who they're becoming and how far they've come as leaders in their villages and communities. Then, as I pin a medal on their graduation gown, I whisper to each witch doctor, just loud enough for them to hear, "Don't make me kill you." They're not sure whether I'm joking or not. I'm okay with that tension. We can speak truth to power. I remind them of the consequences for any witch doctor involved in human sacrifice. I let them know that there will be a trial, and after they're convicted, they'll never be seen again. There's no love without justice, but there's no justice without love. I don't think we have any business telling people what to change in their lives unless we're willing to change a couple things in ours. For me, that means taking a step back from my pride, washing feet, and treating my enemies with the kind of selfless love Jesus didn't just talk about, but demonstrated. Not long ago, I got a call at midnight. I was out cold when the phone rang. The call was from two witch doctors from the witch doctor school. They said a little boy has been abducted by a new witch doctor in town. He's taken the child into the bush for a child sacrifice, but we know where he is. There was a pause. Then the two witch doctors asked, "Should we go get the child?" By this time, I was standing on the top of my bed in my boxers shouting, "Get the kid!" 4 hours later, I received a short text message from these two witch doctors who used to do unthinkable wrongs, but have now experienced the power of love and acceptance and grace at our school. Here's the message I received. "We've rescued the child. He's with his mother." And a moment later, I received a text message that simply read, "Love does." I lost it. Maybe you thought you were simply coming to the end of a book. What if I told you this was actually an intervention, and all the people you know have been calling and asking me to break some news to you? You can no longer continue to be the person you've been. What are you going to let go of? Who is it you don't get? Who don't you understand? Who have you been playing it safe with while politely keeping your distance? Who's been mean or rude or flat wrong or creeps you out? Don't tell them all your opinions. Give them all your love. I know it's hard for you. It's hard for me too. But I'm learning I have to follow Jesus' example and follow his lead if I'm going to follow in his steps. Even when we feel like we can't muster the strength and humility to love our enemies, the truth is we can. If you do this, I can promise two things will happen. First, it will be messy, sometimes ugly messy. You'll also be misunderstood. You might not even understand yourself anymore. The second thing is just as true. You'll grow. And people who are growing fall forward and bump into Jesus all over again. Obeying Jesus when it comes to loving difficult people is hard. I'm still working on it. I'm sure it will take the rest of my life. The heavy lifting is worth it, though. Difficulties and setbacks will give us the chance to go back or lean forward once again. I'm convinced heaven is watching us, knowing full well that all that will be left standing in the end is our love. I bet our spouses, kids, and friends are watching, too. If you want to become love, stop just agreeing with Jesus. Go call someone right now. Lift them up in ways they can't lift themselves. Send them a text message and say you're sorry. I know they don't deserve it. You didn't either. Don't put a toe in the water with your love. Grab your knees and do a cannonball. Move from the bleachers to the field, and you won't ever be the same. Don't just love the people who are easy to love. Go love the difficult ones. If you do this, Jesus said two things would happen. First, he said you'd move forward in your journey towards being more like him. And second, as you love everybody always, you'll turn into love along the way. Epilogue. It's been a busy year. I got malaria on a trip to Uganda and almost died. I could have avoided it by taking a nickel pill and drinking a half glass of water. you can probably avoid some of what's been killing your joy just as easily. The lodge that took us 22 years to build burned to the ground, along with everything we loved inside of it. We keep reminding each other we're sad but not stuck. Memories aren't flammable. Carol is still in heaven. I don't watch baseball, but she loved the Red Sox. I told her before she went home, I would wear her Red Sox hat and represent them here so long as she mentioned my name to Jesus when he passed by. I hope she's keeping up her end of the deal. The limo driver retired and probably found a great deal on a used yellow truck. Lex is still jumping big. He won the silver medal in the Rio de Janeiro Paralympics and the gold medal in the London World Paralympics Championships. Adam and I are still skydiving, but he goes more often than I do. Lex is planning on taking lessons and will be jumping with us soon. I know, I thought it was a bad idea too. Last one, best one. I went back to the wax museum and they turned it into a hot yoga studio. They didn't, of course, but I thought it would be pretty boss if I could tell you they did. I wear my Letterman jacket, but only when I go to the pizza place. I'm there for the food these days, not the tickets. I still play the piano and hit lots of wrong notes, but my friends keep tapping their feet as if I didn't. My eyesight hasn't come back all the way, but I continue to see more each day. I've gotten to know the new guy at TSA who took over for Adrian, and Carl is retiring from the Attorney General's office after 20 years of navigating his faith in love. I haven't been invited back to the White House, but that's okay. Walter still meets people at the airport with his smile. I still get a dozen calls a week from jails and have plenty of prison socks if you need a pair. I still carry my bucket around when I need to, which is most of the time. I haven't been to another crop drop, but next time I go, I'm filling my bucket with crocodiles and letting a couple loose in the room to see how fast our church can get up on the tables. We're still meeting with witch doctors and enrolling them in our schools. The daughter of the head of the witch doctors enrolled in our high school. Parent-teacher conferences just got a lot more interesting. Oh, and the fingerprints on the cover of this book? I got the witch doctors in our school in Gulu together, and most of the fingerprints are theirs. One of the girls in our safe house in Uganda just started law school. She's our fourth Love Does student who is on the path to becoming a lawyer. They don't want to practice law. They want to do justice. There's a big difference between the two. Kabi got sick and died unexpectedly. I'm kind of hoping we're not roommates when I get to heaven. Either way, because he found his way to the feet of Jesus, I expect to be spending a lot of time with him, but I still don't get it. I keep asking Charlie where he wants to go, and thankfully he hasn't said Mount Kilimanjaro again. We did get some news I'm still trying to get my head around. He went in for an X-ray recently, and from what they discovered, it turns out some of the parts we thought were gone had actually retracted and are actually there. The doctors say there's no reason he can't be a father someday. I don't get that either, and neither do any of the surgeons who operated on him. He will be getting another restorative operation soon. It's nuts. One thing has remained the same. Every time I wonder who I should love and for how long I should love them, God continues to whisper to me, everybody, always. See you on Tom Sawyer Island, Bob.
You've been listening to the audio production of Everybody Always, Becoming Love in a World Full of Setbacks and Difficult People. Text copyright 2018 by Bob Goff. Production copyright 2018 by Nelson Books. No portion of this recording may be reproduced without the prior written consent of the publisher. For more information on other fine books and audio products from Nelson Books, please visit your favorite retailer or visit us online at thomasnelson.com. Everybody Always was recorded at Verity Audio Productions in San Marcos, California.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.